Section 5 covers tips about phrasing that aren't so mathematically locked into just playing quarters and halves and wholes and everything. And they cover perhaps one of the most important elements that we've left out completely so far in this whole thing. And I don't mean to suggest that I don't mean to suggest that it's not important. It's extremely important. I just left it out because it gets confusing trying to teach it all at the same time. And that is rests and space. Okay? For every rest, I'm not going to write these out because it can be a lot to look at for your purposes right now. But for every whole note attack doesn't mean you're necessarily, you know, playing violently on your guitar. It just means the opposite of a rest. For every type of attack, meaning whole note, half note, quarter note, or eighth note or sixteenth note, there's an equivalent rest. Okay, I'm not going to write out the symbols for you, but this is a huge important thing when it comes to phrasing. Guitarists are notorious for not making good phrasing because they never stop. And I think it's because of breathing. Like when you play a horn, let me just shut the metronome off for a second. This is an extremely important thing. When you play a horn, a saxophone, a clarinet, a trumpet, trombone, whatever it is, you know, you run out of breath. And you have to stop your phrases in between. It just doesn't sound right. You know, I've heard of piano players actually holding their breath while they play because they don't want to get too... like guitarists do, they don't want to have these run-on phrases. You know, if you were to meet somebody and all they did was talk like this and they never get a rest and all they kept on saying was different things and whatever came into their mouth, they never shut up the whole time, you would not want to talk to that person. So why do you think that people are going to want to listen to your music when you don't leave a breath in between? Okay, so this is a huge thing. So I want you to go back and review. I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time on this, but this doesn't mean it's not hugely important. Whatever note you have, you can have the equivalent rest. So if you play a whole note, 2, 3, 4, then rest for 4 beats as well. 2, 3, 4, then rest for 4 beats. Let's do half note. So half note, and then rest for 2 beats. And rest for 2 beats. So half note, let's do it back and forth. So like this, half note, and then rest for 2 beats. A half note, rest. Rest, rest. Rest, rest. Okay, quarter note. All right, we're gonna do a quarter note, and then rest for 1 quarter note. So quarter, rest, quarter, rest, quarter, rest, quarter. You get the idea. So, and then eighth notes. It would be, but that can be harder to hear, so we're actually resting on the back side of each beat. But what about if we put the rest in the front side so you can hear it better? It would sound like this. Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, rest, and rest, and rest, and... If you're going to try and play along with that, it would be picking on the upstrokes. And instead of picking a note on the way down, you're resting. So just to explain what I just did, when I put the rest on the backside of the beat, it's harder to hear. So it's rest, 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 rest. But students aren't typically in control of muting their notes quick enough. And I have a feeling that those will be harder to hear. So I'm putting the eighth note rest on the front side, if this makes any sense, and it's much more able to hear. So here we go, like rest and 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 rest. Get the idea? If you do 16th notes, it's the same phenomenon. If you put the rest on the back side, so like you could play on the 1, rest on the E. Play on the N, rest on the and it would sound like this. But again, the muting thing, it's not really effective for a demonstration. So let's put the rest on the front side, and it would sound like this. Resty, resta, resty, resta, resty, resta, resty, resta. It's pretty funny, right? Here we go. I'm gonna demonstrate. 2, 3, 4. Alright, so anyway, leaving space in your phrases is a huge thing, and I want you to practice making phrases that allow for rests. When we did our little two-bar phrases, we didn't rest at all. None of these exercises have any rests at all, but let's demonstrate that a little bit. Let's do a two-bar phrase where the whole second bar is a rest. All right, so 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, it's cool phrasing, right? It's super cool. If you play like that, your friends are gonna be like, wow, this is cool. Let's do like the rest in the first part of the bar, a first part, like a two bar phrase where the first thing you experience, or I shouldn't say hear, but is a half note rest. So it would be like this. So 1, 2, 3, 4, rest. Rest. And then 1. All right, again. Rest. Rest. Okay, that's a big deal for you guys. I have a feeling this is a something that you don't just get right away. But practice, like, best way to do it is practice resting right away in your phrase, in the two-bar structure. So we just did a half-note rest. Let's do a quarter-note rest up front. So 1, 2, 3, 4, rest. And then again, rest. All right, again, rest. Okay, what about an eighth note rest right up front? Like 1, 2, 3, 4. And again. Okay. What about multiple rests? Okay, good. And this reminds me of something. When I was saying about how the tension band was too long when I was trying to do four bar phrases, is because I was only working with attacks. There's no rests involved. Now, I just want to see if my theory is true. Obviously, I'm doing this in real time. I'm not editing this. But, see if I can do four bar phrase with rests now, and I guarantee it'll be so much easier. So just on the fly, let me demonstrate four bar phrase with rests. So 1, 2, 3, 4. And it's a piece of cake. I did it perfectly because I'm sculpting. You're sculpting. You know, let's talk about music as art for a second. You know, we don't do this enough. We never talk about this. The more abstract-minded of you guys, you know, art is the place where form and formlessness come together. I don't know if this is too deep for some of you, but, you know, if you think of, let's say, creation. I don't know, I want to get too philosophical for you guys. Like, creation is a process. When you look at the world, or any the universe, let's say, the universe is mostly space. And things are constantly coming in and out of existence. Stars are, you know, exploding and you know, supernova and all this. And it's a very alive, vibrant. And if you come right down to our very planet, you know, animals, fish, people, trees, whatever, they die or they're born. They come to life and they're... So everything is an ebb and flow of existence and non-existence. You know, the idea of the creator, you know, actually, let me just bring a little Eastern philosophy into it. The idea of the creator, God, if you will, in Eastern religions is also the same as the destroyer, meaning that which is coming into life has been predicated by something else leaving or going out of existence. In your own life, you notice that there are cycles. When you move into a different phase of life, you were only able to move into that phase because the prior thing had been given up. You know, you can only establish new good in yourself when you allow for, you know, things to move on. If you hang on to, I'm sure you've all experienced times like this. I certainly have. If you hang on to things like the way that you think the way they should be, you actually make your own suffering. You create your own suffering because you're not moving along with the universe. So this whole idea of the manifest and the unmanifest being part of the same coin, if you will. And I think, just on a personal note, I think human beings, we tend to get attached to what we think should be or what shouldn't be, and that creates suffering. Whereas if we allow, and I'm not saying to resign yourself to fate that you can't do anything or change anything. It's within your power to change anything. You're a very, very powerful person, a very powerful creator. But you can only best create when the planes have been leveled, if you will, if you're not hanging on to old things that shouldn't be there anymore. Does this make sense? So in your musical life, you know, you're an artist. Sculpt like a painter does, or a sculptor, or a visual artist. You know, one of my favorite visual... Now I'm really digressing. In a museum in Beacon, New York. I can't remember what the museum is called, but it's a fantastic museum. I don't know if that exhibit is still there, but it was a bunch of taped lines to suggest a bigger three-dimensional space. And when I say taped lines, they were just like kind of like these cords that were taped like a blue color or something. And they were arranged in certain configurations to make you think that there were actual objects there when it really wasn't. It was just space. And it was one of my favorite exhibits. It gives you the illusion that the thing that's not really there is really there. And I think it's a commentary on, you know, how we think things are so there, but then everything is only temporary. You know, everything you see, okay, this desk or, you know, me or this tape recorder or this, you know, whatever, this metronome, they will all not be around, let's say, even like 100 or 200 years from now. And in the course of human history, that's not very long, you know. So what am I saying? This is... Leaving space is a huge element. Every time I hear myself play, and I saw a video of someone saying the same thing, actually. One of my students was interested in phrasing, and he played this YouTube video for me. And what the guy said was exactly what I always think, which is when I listen to myself playing back, when I record a gig or something, my number one self-criticism is that I'm overplaying and not allowing enough space. So... And on the most creative, the most fun gigs I've ever done, I've allowed so much space. Listen to a piano player like Brad Mehldau, or there's countless examples. You know, on guitar, for example, like John Scofield, or you know, you could name even fast players, metal players. You know, Yngwie Malmsteen, Joe Satriani. You know, in between their phrases is silence. So this is a big deal. I want you to. I wouldn't be going on about this if it wasn't so important. But just dig this for a minute. I'm just going to, before I go to the next thing, just realize that any measure of attack, wholes, halves, quarters, eighths, sixteenths, have their equivalent rests. and just dig. I'm going to just try and leave some space in my lines. You know, I might not be a Brad Meldow, but I can certainly refer to what I'm getting at. Not only was the four-bar phrase easier to manage, but just dig how the whole thing can develop, and it develops with silence. So here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4. The idea, everything I played was punk. It was like Eckhart. You want to read a great book? The best book, one of the best books of all time. It's called The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. Eckhart, last name Tolle. The Power of Now. And he says all creative ideas, you want to know the secret of creativity? It's silence. All creative ideas come from silence, and then they go back into silence. So if you're ever on the bandstand or in a jam session or in any musical situation you're improvising and the ideas are not coming, it means you're playing too much and you're not dipping into the silence. There is an unlimited amount of creativity just below the surface. But we think we're doing it. You know, we think we're in charge and I know my scales and I'm in charge. But really we're not. We're just allowing the greater creativity to flow through us. So remember about the silence. Okay, then the other items about the phrasing would be motifs. We talked about this already, but motifs can be melodic as well as rhythmic. We don't have the time really to go into it right now. But if I take a melodic idea, I can make phrases out of that. Meaning, a melodic idea could be like, let's say, it can be anything from like any particular note or a double stop or something. Let me just try it with one note and we'll see. And I just, let's say I particularly like that particular note and I'm going to make a motif out of it. Not a very good example, but I like the sound of that particular note right there, and I was trying to play around with it. I guess a more reliable motif might be like the distance between two notes. So let's say, I don't know, you know, like a distance of a sixth. So this is just an example. So playing around now in that particular case, the motif was rhythmic and melodic. I'm playing around with a sixth, and I was also using the same rhythmic motif at the same time. You don't have to do it like that. Suppose I did a sixth that wasn't an intervallic motif that wasn't locked in with a rhythm. So let's say it was like the interval of a fifth. So, but I won't do it with rhythm. I'll just do the interval itself. So here we go. Thank you. get the idea. I could go around all day, and you actually, you can get outside the key and things like that, and people will go with you, and it won't sound wrong because of the motif is so strong. So again, I didn't really define what a motif was. It's any idea, whether it's rhythmic or melodic, that can be reduced and expanded. I could go on and on with this. You can, once you have an idea, you can see how I, with that little idea, I contracted it and I expanded it, and I could do all kinds of things. We're running out of time on this, but that's a huge topic in and of itself. I could easily have a whole nother hour just on motifs. And then the final thing is, you're just trying, your overall thing is to convey emotion, you know. Try and convey in your phrasing, you know, almost as if you're telling a story. I use the example of someone who won't stop talking and they keep on playing, blah, 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 blah. On the flip side is true, too. If you get someone who's too quiet, they don't want to talk, they don't want to offer anything to the table, then you kind of don't want to sit next to that person at a party either. You know what I mean? So your job is to deliver emotion in your playing. So whether it's using the techniques that we talked about, like, you know, string bending and double stops and hammer-ons and pull-ups and all this stuff, yeah, that's cool. But the phrasing should be such that it portrays the emotion you're trying to capture. But it should be rhythmically locked in. Again, if you're going for excitement and you're just playing, you know, and I don't mean to be like that, but I've seen students do that and their rhythms are all over the place. So you have to balance art with kind of logic, if you will. All right? So convey emotion, but stay rhythmically locked in. All right? I'm just going to take us out with a little bit of, hopefully, lyrical playing. You know, there. If you want to listen to lyrical playing, listen to Stan Getz or Lester Young, you know, master saxophone players who were known for their lyricism. You know, Miles Davis was never a fast player, a very technically savvy player. In the guitar world, a lyrical player could be like B.B. King or even Eric Clapton. I mean, he's not the most technically gifted guitarist. He's very lyrical, or Jeff Beck, for example, very lyrical, you know. All right, so we talked about quite a bit. I hope you have fun. Let me know if you have questions, and we'll see you next time. I'm going to try and play some lyrical A minor on the way out. So have a great night. Thank you.